Thank you for listening to We Have Ways of Making You Talk. Sign up to our Patreon to receive bonus content, live streams, and our weekly newsletter with money off books and museum visits as well, plus early access to all live show tickets. That's patreon.com/wehaveways.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Achtung, Achtung, welcome to We Have Ways of Making You Talk, the Second World War podcast for all your Second World War podcast needs. WW2 pod, We Have Ways of Making You Talk, in fact. James, how are you?
Yeah, I'm good, thank you. And, you know, the name change, we've been banging the drum for the SWW for a long time, so now we're having to sort of slyly eat our words. But, you know, and it is interesting because the Italians call it the Second World War. The French call it the Second World War. The Germans call it the Second World War. Everyone calls it the Second World War, apart from the Americans.
Yeah.
But as we know, American culture and American way of saying things does rather dominate. And a shorthand is, there's no doubt about it, that WW2.
WW2.
And we live in a world of shorthands, don't we?
Yes, yes. SWW, would have a lot of people scratching their heads immediately rather than instantly seeing what it is. Anyway,
Guerra Secondo Mondiale.
Or Great Patriotic War, or the Second 30 Years War. I mean, we could go for that if you wanted. Right. So, and what we thought we'd do, answer some questions. So Kyle Glover, so he asks, the Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare, are you looking forward to the film? Looking forward to it,
yeah,
or
100%.
Not? Yeah, absolutely.
No, 100%. I can't wait. Yeah. I love Guy Ritchie movies. Yeah. And I'm really, really looking forward to this. I mean, I think you have to go into a movie like that with exactly the right frame of mind, which is you're just going to be entertained for an hour and a half.
Yeah.
And it's going to have some people dressed in Second World War costumes, and it's going to have some Second World War weapons.
Yeah.
And that's about it. In terms of historical accuracy,
there's going to be a brain gun.
Because I do have to know it's a raid in West Africa, and there's lots of German stuff, which obviously there wasn't.
Yeah.
And you know, the whole cast of kind of badasses doesn't make any sense whatsoever. And,
you know,
but everything about it is historically wrong. But who cares?
But the tagline is, if Hitler isn't playing by the rules, then neither shall we. If it's ungentlemanly warfare, someone says, if Hitler isn't playing by the rules, then why should we?
Exactly. Well, no, I think Henry Cavill is very much taking that that kind of accent, that approach. I mean, I've seen the trailer and stuff. I mean, it looks great. I love Henry Cavill anyway. I mean, he's great. He should be Bond.
The thing is there, you know, the questions of ungentlemanly warfare. I mean, this is about SOE, isn't it? But there's also the sort of Churchill toy shop and all this sort of, you know, all these people between the cracks that attract stories. So it's a little surprises a movie called this.
Yes, and also let's not beat about the bush. I mean, the Guns of Navarone isn't exactly historically accurate. Or the Sea Wolves, or, you know, any of these films. I mean, it's a movie. I mean, who cares? I mean, I am really, really looking forward to it because I'm a big Guy Ritchie fan. I love his stuff. I think I thought The Man from U.N.C.L.E. was utterly brilliant. And I know it got a bit panned at the time, but I thought it was just completely tremendous.
It was very stylish, wasn't it?
Yeah. Very stylish. And, you know, that's what I want from a movie. Also, the other thing I like about it is and he makes films that last about an hour and 40 minutes, which is about right, I think. You know, I don't go with these kind of 3.5 hour epic sort of auteur things. It always seems self-indulgent to me.
So, let's go to Simon's question. If the US bombers are continuing to experience the losses of late 42, early 43, longer term, into late 43, you could argue, due to escort fighters, do you think they would have been forced into changing to night bombing, or they would have stuck to their guns to save face? I mean, they do try night bombing, don't they? They do. They do in mid 43, don't they? They do send some people out on night sorties with the RAF, don't they?
I think that's a really, really interesting question.
It is, isn't it?
No, I think they would have come up with a solution.
They would have
got Spitfires, or they'd have had more P-38s. They just would have come up with a solution. The idea that there's no P-51 ever. I mean, the point about the P-51 is it's the most efficient aircraft that you can put long range tanks on because of its fuel efficiency. But it's not like there aren't other planes that you could do that to.
So
you would just do that and you would adjust accordingly.
And it would take longer. To break the Luftwaffe.
I mean, don't forget the whole kind of build up of forces in Italy, for example. That is all about what do we do if we don't have enough long range fighters to get us into the Reich. I mean, that's what that's all about. The increase of 6 bomb groups to the Foggia airfield complex to 21 is all about that. I think they just would have found a solution. I can't see any circumstances in which they would have had a vault fast and changed to night bombing.
I think he's absolutely right. The expression "save face" is right in this, Simon. There was a lot of face in this involved, an awful lot of, because a big part of this is about proving the efficacy of an air force that's not part of the army, isn't it? That what you need is an air force that isn't part of the army, and the lobby that has got this far with daytime precision bombing is that lobby, isn't it? So they're you know, they're hardly going to, it's going to be very, very difficult for them to back down. And also they've spent so much money on this. You know, I mean, it's like when the B-29 comes along, the B-29, you know, they commit to building it before it's flown. You know, it's the most extraordinary project. James Scott's book, so much of that book, you can read the tone. I read that very much as there are an awful lot of people who, they're as determined to be right as to win the war, as they were to win the war, that being proved right was a cornerstone of how a lot of them were going about it. And that mattered as much as defeating Japan, which I think is kind of amazing, really. You know, the power of ideology and the power of people with an ideology, you know, once they're given their head, you know, all of this is blank page thinking, all of it, blank page thinking, blank page theorizing, blank page science. But, you know, there's no such thing as strategic bombing in 1939. There's really no such thing as strategic bombing in 1940 either, even though the RAF are trying it. It doesn't exist. And so for the Americans,
they don't really know how that manifests itself, do they?
No. They've talked about it a lot. RAF have talked about it an awful lot. And again, so much of it is that what you've got is, in the UK, you've got sort of riding the rapids of disarmament and technological change and ideas about technology. You know, so they're trying to negotiate that slalom. And in America, it's that, you know, what do you even need? You know, isolationist America, what do you even need an Air Force for? Protecting your coast. I mean, so strategic bombing couldn't be any further off the shopping list. And yet these people end up in charge. So by the time, I think, you know, so much of it is about saving face. I think it's absolutely fascinating. And then by the time you get to Japan, where you've built the B-29 that's meant to be a stratospheric bomber, and then you're using it at low level to bomb Tokyo at night, it's as if none of these arguments amount to anything. It's very weird. That the Tokyo raid, for the fact that they used the B-29s at low level, having spent all that money on designing a bomber that's meant to be, you know, that's pressurized, that you can fly as high as possible.
Yeah, I kind of don't forget the guy who's running that is Curtis LeMay, who has been commander of the 3rd Division in with the 8th Air Force in Britain, and so has had lots and lots of interaction with Bomber Command as well as his peers and you know, compadres in 8th Air Force.
Well, he's no theorist.
But the reason why they're stubbornly sticking to this is because they've gone, we don't want to be doing what the RAF Bomber Command are doing. It's not night bombing per se, I don't think. I mean, it was to start off with, but as time goes on, that's not the issue. The issue is we want to be doing our own thing. We want to be doing this. And there is an advantage for doing round-the-clock bombing. And there is also, self-evidently, a massive advantage on Operation Point Blank, which, for those who can't remember, who haven't heard any of the earlier episodes, is a directive that comes out in June 1943, which prioritizes destruction of the German aircraft industry and the Luftwaffe over any other target. That's what daylight precision bombing is all about. It's all about Operation Point Blank.
Yeah.
Whereas in the Pacific, the US Army Air Force on their own, they haven't got the RAF Bomber Command to worry about. They haven't got kind of the boffins in Whitehall breathing down their necks. You know, they can do their own thing. And so you can change it and you can adapt. And I think actually having operational flexibility is really important. I know you're really struck with this concept of everyone's following, you know, everyone's an ideologue in the Second World War at the highest level. And I think that's incredibly convincing, actually. And the more I've thought about it since you first mentioned it, the more I kind of agree with you, because clearly there is some major ideology going on here, which is particularly in the bomber war, which is developed from the kind of bomber mafia of the 1930s, so-called, into... okay, this isn't going quite as planned, but we're going to stick to it in the case of a European war, through to, okay, what does the future look like? The United States Army Air Force is absolutely the cutting edge of new technology, new inventions, new defense projects, you know, from the atomic bomb, which is obviously going to have to be delivered by the United States Army Air Force, through to jet technology, through to the B-29s, et cetera, et cetera. What is interesting about the Second World War is although bombing and air power doesn't deliver victory in itself, it remains, and that was always the kind of the panacea that they the bomber men and the airmen believed in. When the war is over, even more so is it going the future going to be dictated by air power?
And
the B-29 is the answer to that. So are all the flattened cities of Germany. So is the atomic bomb. You know, that is the future. And also what else is also the future is jet technology. And in that, obviously, you know, Britain has the lead in the post-war years. And it's interesting that for Britain post 1945, research and development and future defense is all about air power. It's not about Navy. It's not about the army. It's all about air power. It is developing jet technology. And then it's about developing commercial air power as well as military air power. And that's how you rebuild Britain, you know, economically as well as rebuilding Britain's defences. I mean, it's amazing. It's all about air power.
The similar current that downplays the effect of bombing, the efficacy of bombing, at the same time as amping up its cruelty, demanding that the moral questions be asked. Do you think that's a Cold War response to the threat of nuclear war? That basically there's a kind of, you know, blowback, which is, look, bombing didn't work. It didn't win the war. It didn't succeed. And look at the destruction. As a kind of, in the tone of nuclear, you know, the idea that nuclear war won't work, is pointless, is wantonly cruel or something. You know what I mean? That's part of the mix, because you know, Bomber Command and what they, as well as being sort of shoved aside politically by Churchill, basically as the war's ending. You know, Bomber Command is not a respectable thing for the decades that follow the Second World War, is it? And even to the point, the RAF. Calls itself Strike Command, changes its name, you know, like they rebrand.
Yeah.
Because the branding's no good, you know. And I think
I think there was deep disquiet and discomfort about bombing right from the word go, actually.
Yeah.
I think flattening cities sits very uncomfortably with people. And it's all very well going, but look at Coventry. The answer to that is, look at Coventry.
You know,
two wrongs don't make a right. And yet, isn't it interesting that every time there's a major conflict rather than a kind of insurrection, every time there's a major conflict, what happens? Cities get, and towns and things get flattened. Look at Gaza, look at Ukraine.
Look at Syria
is absolutely, look at all these places, you know, they're still getting flattened. And I think there is, my sense is that flattening cities has never gone away. And I think if there was another war, I think air power would absolutely have a major role again and more cities would get flattened. If it escalated out of Ukraine, for example. I think it's all very well being holier than thou and going, oh, you know, we don't like it, it's horrible. But I can promise you, the moment there was a conventional war, that is exactly what would happen.
Yeah.
You know, because the point is, you're supposed to protect civilian life and avoid it. But how do you avoid it if your military target is right in the middle of Bristol? Berlin.
Well, fired all your cruise missiles off in the first fortnight. Now what?
Right. I mean, you know, I still think air power has a long way to go. Is my hunch.
Well, there we go. But saving face, I think, is a big part of it. It's little wonder that it's a war of ideologies, though, because after all, there's not been one like it. Ranges of aircraft mean that the aircraft will change the battlefield forever in the Second World War. In a way, it couldn't in the First World War. That and missiles, obviously, because that's the other thing. You know, in the end, the British abandoned the jet. UK abandons its place in the jet race and buys some Polaris missiles, doesn't it? Sticks them under an ice cap, you know. Yeah. Right. Okay. Mark Richmond says, was there any pro-Axis group on Malta that would have supported an Italian-German invasion?
Well, it was to start off with, and they were all kicked off the island and sent off to wherever they were sent. I can't remember where they were packed off to, but loads of them were kind of put in prison or kind of, you know,
So Uganda deported. Or somewhere, right? Yeah.
Yeah, was it? Well, really, I think it was like Uganda. Yeah, I think it absolutely was something like that. Then there was a spy called Carmelo Borg Pisani who was a young guy who made a complete hash of it. He was an Axis spy. He came over by boat. His boat got wrecked or something off the Dingley Cliffs. I can't quite remember. But anyway, he came ashore, got caught within about a minute, and was hanged in November 1942. There wasn't a lot, but you know what it was. Clamped down very, very hard. You know, there were pro-Italian, particularly in the 1930s. You know, I mean, Malta's a very, very odd marriage between the British ever since sort of 1800 when Nelson took it over, came in after the Battle of the Nile.
Yeah.
Through to, I think it was 1814, if I remember rightly, was when it formally became a British protectorate. And, you know, it was British in the same way that Gibraltar or the Falkland Islands are British.
Yeah.
You know, it's British pounds, all the rest of it. And there was kind of no representation in the House of Commons or anything like that. But you know, it was British. It had been since the early 19th century. So those ties ran very deep. But on the face of it, it shouldn't have really worked because obviously Britain is Northern European and Protestant and Malta is one of the most Catholic places in the whole of Europe. But it kind of sort of did. You know, everyone kind of sort of rubbed along and you know, everyone, most Maltese people recognised the kind of sort of mutual benefits of being part of a, you know, the massive machine that was the British Empire. And you know, and obviously the Royal Navy, the Mediterranean Fleet had its base there. And that was the kind of absolute kind of basis on which, you know, the relationship really, really worked. You know, there was lots of employment in the docks of stevedores and shipbuilders and ship repair workshops and all the rest of it, and indeed the Navy and Merchant Navy. And Britain in turn kind of brought in lots of money. Yeah.
Money, jobs, and also keeps the Sicilians off your back too. It sort of guarantees
all of that.
A peculiar kind of autonomy, paradoxical sort of autonomy, isn't it? Is that Malta gets to be Malta under the protection of the Royal Navy in a way that it wouldn't if the Royal Navy weren't there. You know, it might end up being a Sicilian outpost.
If you can be rich and you know, or comparatively well off and economically sound and democratic and have all your freedoms, why would you want to be under a fascist dictatorship? I mean, the whole point about the fascist dictatorship is because democracy is broken and, you know, we're impoverished and the country isn't working. So let's get a strong man in to kind of sort of fix all this stuff.
Yeah.
That's the whole point of Mussolini in 1922. But if you don't have that problem, then you don't need the strong man dictator, do you?
Yeah, exactly.
So from a Maltese point of view, why on earth would you want, you know, fascist Italy, I'm telling you what.
It's interesting, though, that the British don't scoop up all the other, that Pantelleria isn't also a, you know what I mean? That all the islands aren't scooped up in that part of the world.
Yeah.
Clearly, the Navy thought Malta was sufficient.
Well, it's just that, you know, those two harbours, Marsmachet and Grand Harbour, you know, they're so deep.
Yeah.
And you know, for all your naval needs, you've just got the one. I mean, don't forget also that, you know, these places don't come about cost. I mean, you know, ultimately why empires always collapse, generally speaking, is because the cost of them outweighs the benefits.
So, I mean, the thing is there are pro-Axis groups absolutely everywhere, all over the world, before the war, and some of them then evaporate. You read about so many people in this country who are basically, the minute the war comes, they go to, you know, they're called to their colours and they do their duty. But right up to that point, there's a whole load of people who think that the Nazis are, you know, look like they're doing a good job in a difficult place and all that sort of thing, you know.
Or bring a bit of order, discipline.
And whose business is Germany? You know, it's not our business what's happening in Germany anyway, which is, I think, a huge factor, actually.
People of a long, you know, people far off place about whom we know very little.
And all that, which I think I would always admire Chamberlain's brass neck when he says that, given the British Empire. People in a far India.
Yeah, but all he's doing is he's reflecting 92% of the population.
I know, which is kind of amazing, really, like, given the British Empire. You know, like, we're one great big business that's involved in far off places of which we know little. Anyway, I I digress.
Yeah, but I mean, but it is interesting in you know, in the autumn of 1938, the height of the Munich crisis. You know, Chamberlain's widely seen as a great success and a huge hero for kind of preventing war and for sorting it out. I mean, you know, it's a brave prime minister that goes against the wishes of over 90% of the population.
Yes, he's done the right thing for the moment, and I think
whilst at the same time rearming and strengthening the navy and the air force.
Within his range of political options, what are his actual political options at this point?
Yeah, I mean, that's my point.
What really are they? You know, and after all, politicians can generally only act within their options. Or you know, they then have to be lucky, don't they? Is the thing.
Well, yes, but what you do need to do is you need to make sure that you're preparing in multiple different ways for an eventuality that might still occur, whether that be building up your armed forces or whether that be sort of changing the narrative in the media.
And he's doing that. He's doing that,
which he is doing.
Fortress Britain is the way he's looking at it, isn't he?
Yeah.
Rather than necessarily, the kind of offensive war the British end up having to fight. The idea is that he's going to put the shutters up, and no one's going to get in. Yes, but I mean, there are pro-Axis people in absolutely everywhere in every walk of life, right up until the minute there aren't. Anyway, we need to take a quick break, and then we'll be back with some more questions.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Welcome back to We Have Ways of Making You Talk. Foamface asks, short but simple, best operation name of the war?
Got to be Gamora, hasn't it?
You see, I think what's really interesting about Gamora is, you know, there's the whole thing where around the D-Day thing where Churchill's sort of saying, I don't want any of my men killed in Operation Jellyfish or whatever.
Called Jelly.
It's not going to happen on my, you know, hands. No man must give his life, blah, 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 and all that. Gamora, that's kind of, you know, modern American operation names are kind of like Operation Divine Justice of Vengeance or whatever. Or,
exactly.
You know, or Righteous More or whatever. With apologies to our American listeners, but you know, British military operations these days tend to be Operation Grouting or Operation...
Biting.
Well, biting's Bruneval, isn't it? But at least that's...
Yeah, I know, but no, I still think that just doesn't sound right for an operation.
Grapple. Grapple. Granby.
Grapple. Granby. Yeah, Granby and Herrick and stuff.
It's Herrick and all that. Rather than, you know, Divine Shield of Almighty Justice. but Gamora, is that's very interesting, isn't it? Because I mean, let's just say Gamora had gone wrong and they hadn't caused a firestorm, then it's a bit of a silly name for it, isn't it?
You know. It did go right, so...
I know.
I mean, I think there's lots of really good names. I mean, Retribution's good, isn't it?
I read Rob Hutton's book about Dudley Clark recently. I really like Cascade, Clark's name for his disinformation campaign, because that's what it is. It's good to have an operational name that tells you, I mean, without giving the game away, tells you what's going on. You know, it's a cascade of information that the enemy is cascaded with and he can't work out what's true and what isn't.
And there's another Dudley Clark one, which is, I just like Operation Animals.
Yeah, that's really good.
I've always
good.
Liked that one. That's the one really in Greece, good. You know, where they did 42 operations in a couple of months prior to Husky. Operation Animals is just it's one of my favourite ones of all. It's just a really good name. Yeah. But let's go Animals then. Yeah.
Right, animals of Cascade. Animals. We're going to Animals, I think. We'll go Operation Animals.
I just think it's a great name.
It is. It's brilliant. Now, Matty Palmer, though, asks, how does a soldier get awarded a VC, aside from doing something incredibly brave and amazing in the Second World War? What's the process involved? Well, first of all, it has to have been seen.
It has to have been
witnessed. Because after all, I mean, there must have been all sorts of people who've got up to a gun pit and killed all five Germans in it and then been killed themselves, and no one knows about it because all the people with him also cut down, you know, or it happens noises off. It happens sort of off stage, as it were. I mean, that's the very first part of it. It has to be seen. Generally, it has to be seen by an officer, doesn't it, as well? So it's...
Yes.
Witnessing is really, really important.
Inevitably, what happens is lots more people get put forward for VCs and actually are awarded. Yep. It tends to go from, you know, sort of battalion commander or whatever up to brigadier, division, and it goes, and a VC goes all the way to the top, and then it has to be signed off by you know, Monty in the case of 21st Army Group, yeah, Northwest Europe. It goes right to the top, or, you know, if it's 1942, it would go all the way up to Alexander as CNC in Middle East or whatever. Yeah. It's right to the top. And it has to be so obviously not a more than a DSO,
yeah,
that it's got to be. And actually, it's really interesting with the Paddy Mayne ones, because he famously gets what it is, four DSOs and never quite gets the VC. You could argue with Paddy Mayne that he deserves an accumulative VC, which is what various of the airmen get.
Yeah.
It's what Leonard Cheshire gets, for example. But not one of his actions for which he gets a DSO is probably worthy of a VC in its own right. That's the thing. The point about VC is you have to be saving lots of other men's lives by unbelievably reckless regard for your own safety.
Total disregard for your personal safety. It's total disregard, isn't it?
Total disregard.
Yeah.
And so the vast majority of them are inevitably posthumous, because the total disregard bit is the kind of rub in the whole thing. But that's how you get it. And most of them get, most of the recommendations get shoved down to DSO or even MC.
But
that's how it works.
But there's more to it than that, isn't there? Because at Rorke's Drift, for instance, and I know it's not the second one.
Yeah, but early days.
They dole them out, right? And they can sometimes. It's sort of, you know, iron filings. If there's been a disaster, sometimes... That suddenly there's a sort
there's
of
a bit
outbreak.
Of that going on with Market Garden, isn't there?
Oh, God. Five VCs for one action. I think that's entirely what's going on. Which is not to say that any of the people that receive their VCs, that it's not a,
don't deserve
not,
them.
They don't deserve them. I mean, it's quite the opposite. I mean, you can think of 10 people in Market Garden who should have got them when you start to get into it. Jeffrey Powell, who's a company commander in 156 Para, when David Lord's plane goes down on the Tuesday afternoon, like at 3:08 or whatever, in flames on the supply drop, he turns to the bloke next to him and says, "That bugger got a VC." And he does get a VC. And around Market Garden before it, there's an awful lot of VC chat. They're all joking about it, you know. When the Comet plan comes up, this one's going to get you a wooden cross or a Victoria cross, this operation. You know, and there's a sort of, because they're such gung-ho people, there's a culture of, you know, they're talking about it all the time. But then you also suspect that there's a lot of banter about it, you know, as well. But that, I mean, when there's a disaster, you know, because I always think it's interesting there's only one on D-Day, you know.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's amazing. And you think also that sort of, you know, David Render in Sherwood Rangers doesn't get an MC. He doesn't get an MC despite repeatedly putting his life in, you know, unspeakable danger over and over again. And
Would it be him saying to Stanley Christopherson, please don't write me up? I mean, you know. No,
he was pissed off about it.
Okay, fine.
He was pissed off about it. You know, he'd much rather be alive and not have an MC than have an MC and be dead. But he felt his survival worked against him on the Ghana Gong front. And he was a little bit sore about it because other people had got MCs for less than he had done. And that was absolutely the case. I mean, you know, he was not wrong in that at all. You know, it is a lottery and everyone knows it's a lottery and no one gets a gong who does, you know, very, very few people get gongs who don't deserve them.
Well, this is
but
it.
There's a lot of
this
people who do deserve them but don't get them.
Don't get
I think
them.
That's the point. So it's an unfair system, but it's not that unfair. And also there is this whole thing about, you know, when you get a DSO or an MC or a VC or whatever, it's not, the VC is different. That is all about the individual. But other gongs, they're kind of representative of a unit or whatever. You know, there's a kind of allocation that you can't have too many people with MCs, for example, in any one battalion, etc. So it's kind of
quotas on bravery are like, I mean, it's in a way
that's absurd, isn't it?
It's crazy, completely crazy. Yeah. And also how. Yeah. You know, how's that going to encourage anyone to be brave?
Right. I mean, it's not a hard and fast rule, but it's a kind of, you know, it's a guideline rule. You know, there's a lot going on with gongs and stuff. But I mean, you know, it's the same anywhere, same now. Why does someone today get an MBE and someone else not? Yeah. You know, there's lots of people who do amazing things for charity. Don't get anything.
Yeah, yeah. There's one more that I want to ask from Brian Williams. The Italian campaign saw serious problems of desertion and indiscipline in the British and US armies. Was there any consideration for the greater use of the death penalty?
Yeah, there was actually. And Alexander suggested it. He said, he said he didn't want to use it. He just wanted it to be there. He said, you know, you might make one example of someone, but he said it's so bad that how are we going to stop this otherwise?
Wow.
Yep.
Yeah. Wow.
Hmm.
That's interesting. And what persuaded him not to start shooting people?
No, he wasn't dissuaded. Jumbo Wilson was, and people further up the chain.
Because Adam definitely looked at it at one point, but as Adjutant General, but
and his attitude, as well.
Yeah, but his attitude in the summer. Adam's attitude was to explore all options. Was his sort of methodology. So I could sort of see why he would have looked at it. But I mean, it's very interesting that in theatre that it's being considered. I mean,
yeah,
the British Army don't shoot anyone or any of their own people, do they? But I mean, did it make you feel differently about Alex reading that? For discovering that?
Well, yeah, you know, a little bit. I mean, you kind of think, oh, come on. But I can also see, you know, he's got a point, hasn't he? I mean, desertion to General Sir H. Maitland Wilson from General the Honourable Sir Harold Alexander. The problem of desertion is a very serious one, and I wish to ask for your personal assistance in dealing with it. It is not, of course, a new problem, but periods of severe fighting, such as the present, bring it to the fore. To show you how serious it is, I might mention that at this very time, there are 450 men awaiting trial in Naples for desertion or absence without leave. These come from three divisions only. Every day, 25 men are being brought in by the military police in Naples, and it is proving difficult to try cases as fast as new ones arise. The fact is that the punishment awarded by courts-martial is inadequate. A sentence of penal servitude is ineffective, firstly, because the man knows that it is likely to be suspended after he has served a short term, secondly, because he counts on a general amnesty at the end of the war. The abolition of the death penalty for desertion has undoubtedly been a great mistake. I have repeatedly emphasised this. I am convinced that this penalty should be reintroduced. If the government is still unwilling to take this step, I urge that at least firm action should be taken to dissipate the prevalent idea that men who shamefully abandon their comrades in action will be allowed full enjoyment of the victory when it is won. It is unfair to the men who stay to fight without the aid of these their disloyal comrade. It is unfair to the man himself. Most of these deserters are not bad men. Many of them have fought well. They would not have disgraced themselves if they had had moral stiffening, which the prospect of adequate punishment would provide.
Yeah.
Okay, just let's remember this is 1944, not 2024, but you know, it's
blimey.
Pretty hard-hitting stuff, obviously.
It is, and, yeah. Blimey.
But you know, the worry is that the whole thing disintegrates.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, we were talking with this, John, when we were with John McManus the other day, about the problems in Italy. Too much is being expected of the infantrymen. No one is going to be executed because they're at their wit's end. You know, is not going to happen. Yeah. That's not what he's suggesting. There's not going to be a kind of sort of, you know, Michael Morpurgo shot at dawn, poor Jimmy, he was only 16 kind of thing.
Yeah.
That isn't going to happen. You know, this is for serial malingerers who are just not pulling their weight.
But that's a really interesting point, though, Jim, because, you know, that's the... A huge tonal shift since the First World War. They shoot 300 people, the British Army.
Yeah, 300, yeah. Something like that. 320, isn't it?
There's a shift that basically, you know, it's got to be serial malingerers that they know in the end they're never going to be able to define who they actually have to shoot. That's the problem, isn't it? In the end, you're never ever going to be able to, not quite. And will it work anyway? I think that's the other. Will executing people work? Probably not, because people will think, well, I could be killed at the front anyway. What difference does it make?
Yeah, I think his point is, if you know that you're, you know, if you desert, all you're going to be doing is letting down your mates, but you're going to basically get away with it.
Yeah.
You know, you might say, well, I'll be in prison for 4 years, but at least I'll be alive in 4 years' time. Whereas, you know, I'll probably get killed next Tuesday. But if you know there's a chance that you might get put before a firing squad, that's quite a bit. It's not just the death. It's the shame. It's the kind of the whole thing. That's quite a big barrier. And there's some further correspondence about it, in which he says, look, I'm not suggesting, you know, I'm suggesting we do this on a very, very extreme and rare case, yeah. but
poor then it's there. Poor encourage les autres, as it were.
It's, yes.
It's Admiral Bing, isn't it? I mean, it is where you end up. It's I mean, it's amazing because the Americans, you know, they do shoot someone. I mean, the Americans execute people for rape and murder, don't they? But they do execute a deserter.
One, but he's a murderer, isn't it? There's only one guy in the whole war who's executed for desertion, but he is also a murderer. So, you know, and a proper scallywag. Obviously, I find the whole thing kind of repellent because the idea disgusting. That anyone has the right to take the life of anybody, I think, is really problematic.
Yeah.
You know, one has to kind of try and put oneself in the shoes of those in charge. And, you know, it is a massive, massive problem. And you know, the problem in Italy is that too much is being expected. You know, too much is being expected of the commanders, frankly, of Alexander and Clark and you know, et al. And too much is being expected of a theatre which is not being properly supplied. You know, this has always been my kind of big point about the Italian campaign. So what do? You've been given an unbelievably tough hand. It doesn't get through, it doesn't get passed, and it doesn't happen. And the desertions continue, and it continues to be an absolute problem, increasingly so after June 1944, actually. I mean, once they got to Rome, everyone really then thinks, okay, we've got to Rome now. You know, that was the objective. Why are we still doing this? You know, if this is a secondary theatre, what's the point? And, you know, they've got a point. So it just gets worse and worse and worse, to be perfectly honest. But, you know, if you're... Yeah, people are executed, don't forget, for murder and for rape and stuff.
Yeah. That's all still going on. Yeah. It's just a question of desertion. And I mean, after all, this is an option that the enemy can resort to quite comfortably, is the thing, offing people. And in fact, one of your allies, you know.
Yeah, and Italians, people who are caught spying for the Axis, you know, for Germany, they're also executed, just as Italians caught sabotaging, you know, on behalf of the Allies against the Germans are also executed. I mean,
Right. Well, we hope we've answered that, Brian. I mean, I think, Jim, you've struggled with that very well. That Alexander should do something like that, and I think you're coping with it well. And
I know it's quite hard. I've been having a couple of hits recently. I've been having a couple of hits recently. You know, sort of slightly dented. I still think he was amazing. He's still my favourite general, but...
you know, I don't mean to do this to you, but, you know.
I know, but he backs Freiburg at Casino. That's hard to square.
Okay, well, I think we've covered a few of those questions, and we'll be endeavouring to answer with a few more. James and I yesterday were talking about stuff on the podcast we've enjoyed doing, and I think it might be worth revisiting family stories at some point, don't you?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's nice. I like hearing those stories, and it's also a reminder, isn't it, that the Second World War is fundamentally about the ordinary man and woman.
So we
caught
so
up in these extraordinary affairs. So if people want to kind of send in their stories again, please do, because let's try and get another series up and running.
So email your family stories to wehavewayspodcast@gmail.com. And I want the words family stories in capitals, or we won't accept them. I also, for the old school listener, I will admit that using email is for old people. And so we're expecting emails from old people only, whereas da kids can send them to us on TikTok or something. I don't know. I don't know that this podcast has a TikTok presence, and that's the way we're keeping it. Anyway, thanks very much for listening. That was a great chat, Jim. Thanks. It's always good to sort of chew round the cud and end up small picture, big picture, in the middle picture. And then seeing James Holland's face on this screen cope so manfully with his disappointment in Harold Alexander is a treat. It's a treat that I get to enjoy and you get to listen to. Anyway, we'll see all of you very soon. Cheerio.
Cheerio.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost 3 decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.